Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 22nd of September, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 8 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we'll return to a very serious case we dealt with here on the show a couple of weeks ago, and then we'll take you to a very mysterious and dangerous part of the planet, supposedly, the Bermuda Triangle. Then, in our movie review section, we'll review a new British period romance, The Young Victoria. So stay tuned for all that and more here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Alright, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so. And I'm afraid to say that today I have pretty much only bad news to report, unfortunately. Our first item comes from Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, where LGBT groups had planned to hold a gay pride march on Sunday, the 20th of September. The last and only attempt at a gay pride event in Belgrade was back in 2001. Unfortunately, that time, after some of the marchers had started to gather in one of the city's main squares, a huge crowd of opponents attacked them, injuring several participants as well as some police officers. So the march was unfortunately abandoned. But this year, a coalition of LGBT groups in Serbia decided to have another go. They got quite a lot of support from international human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, and I was actually involved in the campaign organized by Amnesty over the last week, to email the Serbian authorities urging them to ensure that the marches would be protected and the march could go ahead. Now, it seemed that some of that pressure paid off because just last Friday, 2 days before the march was due to take place, the Serbian president, Boris Tadic, publicly denounced the threats of violence and said that the state would protect the marches. Other ministers also made similar statements. However, the police later said that they wouldn't permit the event to take place in the city because they couldn't offer adequate protection and it would be just too dangerous to go ahead. The police suggested moving the event out of the city to a field on the outskirts of Belgrade. This, though, was unacceptable to the organizers of the march. So on Saturday, they announced that Sunday's march would unfortunately be cancelled. The nationalist and extremist groups that had threatened the march promptly celebrated this announcement, calling it a defeat for the, quote, infidels and Satanists, end quote. So, I mean, that's a real shame. They still have never been able to hold a gay pride march in Serbia. And it's interesting, the politics of this too, because there are broadly two factions within the Serbian political system. One that wants closer integration with Europe and ultimately wants to Serbia to join the European Union, and is therefore trying to bring Serbia's laws into line with EU standards and generally increase protection of human rights, including the right of peaceful assembly for LGBT people. Whereas on the other side, you have the more nationalist conservative strand, more closely aligned to the Orthodox Church, that resist moves for Serbia to integrate more into Europe. And one of the issues that exposes these divisions within the country is the Gay Pride March. Anyway, I think it's probably inevitable which way Serbia will go, and that is towards closer integration with Europe, and eventually we will see a successful LGBT Pride March there. Hopefully quite soon, just not this year, unfortunately. Now, staying in Europe, let's move north to Lithuania, where we have more bad news. And that is that the Lithuanian parliament, the Seimas, just resumed for its autumn session and is debating amendments to two laws that would criminalise the, quote, promotion of homosexual relations in public places, end quote. If adopted, these amendments would permit the criminal prosecution of an extremely wide range of activities, including campaigning on any form of LGBT rights, providing sexual health information to LGBT people, and even organizing LGBT film festivals or pride events. These proposed amendments come on the heels of another awful law that was approved, unfortunately, by the Lithuanian parliament just in July this year, and that is the Law on the Protection of Minors Against the Detrimental Effect of Public Information, which basically bans any mention of LGBT issues in schools or public places or media where it could be viewed by children. But these new proposed amendments go even further than that law and would potentially criminalise almost any public expression of or information about homosexuality. So this is just an awful backward step for Lithuania, which is, I should add, a member of the European Union. Now, Amnesty International currently has a campaign underway to try to stop these horrible amendments from being passed, and I've involved in that campaign as well. And also last Thursday, the European Parliament passed a resolution criticising the homophobic law that was passed in Lithuania in July. So there is increasing international pressure on Lithuania, and let's just hope that that pressure achieves some results and that the law that was passed in July gets abolished and that those nasty new proposed amendments never see the light of day. Okay, and our final bad news item comes from closer to home, from Indonesia, and specifically from the province of Aceh, which, in a compromise deal with the central government back in 2001, was given a certain amount of autonomy over local affairs. Now, Aceh tends to be more conservative and religious than the rest of Indonesia, and the local parliament there has just passed a horrible new law, supposedly based on Sharia law, which will, amongst other things, make homosexuality a crime. The bill says specifically, quote, any person deliberately performing homosexuality or lesbianism is threatened with up to 100 cane lashes and a maximum fine of 1,000 grams of fine gold, or imprisonment of up to 100 months. And just so you don't need to take your calculator out, 100 months is a bit over 8 years. Now, the new law also includes harsh punishments for adultery, including being stoned to death. So a really nice law there, as you can see. Now, the particularly sad part of this, I reckon, is that unlike quite a lot of countries in Asia, Indonesia has never criminalized homosexuality. So it's such a real setback that they're starting now in 2009. The potentially good news, though, is that I have heard from some people with inside information that although this horrible law has been passed by the legislature of Aceh and will come into force in 30 days, the Aceh executive apparently have said that they won't enforce it. Also, a more moderate political party is going to come into power in the Aceh legislature next month, and they oppose the new law. And I've even heard that the central government is considering filing a judicial review of the law with the Indonesian Supreme Court. So, fingers crossed that that awful new law will never be implemented and will, in fact, be quickly repealed. All right, that brings us to an end of our bad news section for today. Let's listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll look at a development in a case that we talked about here on Reality Check 2 weeks ago. And then after that, I'll take you off to the menacing and mystifying Bermuda Triangle. So stay tuned for that after this song here on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I'm Tony Pittman, and the song you just heard there was Snow on the Sahara by Indonesian singer Anggun. Now we move into the part of the show where we get into a skeptical analysis of topics related to the paranormal and the pseudoscientific. And the first item I want to talk about is actually a follow-up to a news story we covered here on Reality Check a couple of weeks ago in episode 6. And it's a very serious issue indeed. In fact, it's as serious as they come, because we're talking here about life and death, literally. This is the case of the 10-year-old girl from Perth, Tamar Stitt, who has liver cancer and whose mother took her out of Australia to El Salvador, in order to avoid a court order requiring her to undergo chemotherapy for the cancer. In El Salvador, her cancer is being treated with a so-called natural therapy, although the family hasn't revealed which particular therapy is being used. Now, I spoke about this case in the context of answering the question, what's the harm with alternative medicine? And I used this case as an example of the harm, that people trust alternative medicines to help them for mild, temporary conditions, but then also believe them to be effective for treating serious, life-threatening illnesses as well. Now, last week, I actually received a comment posted onto the Reality Check website from Tamar Stitt's father, Trevor Stitt. He had heard the podcast of episode 6 and responded to some of the things I said during the show. So today, I'd like to deal with a few points that he raised in his message. If you'd like to read his entire comment, you can do so on the Reality Check website, and that's at realitycheckonline.net. Just go there and click on the comments under episode 6. But before I begin, I just want to make it very clear that I'm not a doctor, and dealing with liver cancer is way beyond any expertise that I may have. All I can do is make very broad statements based on what I know about science and alternative medicine in general. Now, first up in his message, Trevor Stitt informs me that Tamar only has cancer in her liver and not in her stomach. The West Australian newspaper article on which I based my report had said that it was in her stomach as well. So, although I'm not a doctor, it would seem to me that the fact that the cancer is only in her liver is some good news. At least it would seem to mean that it hasn't spread yet to other parts of her body. He also mentioned the type of cancer that she has, and it's called hepatoblastoma. Now, although I didn't know 2 weeks ago what so-called natural treatment Tamar was on, I speculated that it might have been latrile, which is a substance extracted from apricot kernels. Trevor Stitt says in his message that she's not on latrile, so that also seems like potentially good news to me, given that latrile has been proven numerous times to be an ineffective treatment for cancer. Unfortunately, Mr. Stitt didn't mention what treatment is being used. He simply says she is on something that works. He also says the media will fairly soon uncover all you're dying to know. And at another point, he says, within a few weeks, most of what you need to know will be revealed. So I presume here that he's talking about the treatment that Tamar is being given. He later says in his message, and I quote, "I see my daughter every day looking a little better and saying she feels a little better. Would she be lying? Do natural signs lie?" Now here I'd like to respond to what he said. And as I said last time, I can absolutely understand the pain and grief and anguish and desperation that Trevor Stitt and his whole family must be feeling right now, and the nightmarish decisions that they are having to make, decisions that no one would ever want to face in their life. And once again, I'm not a doctor. I'm simply speaking as a layperson with an interest in science and medicine. But in answer to his question, would his daughter be lying when she says she feels a little better? Well, I don't think she'd be lying, but how Tamar feels at any given moment doesn't necessarily indicate that her cancer is going away. With a disease like cancer, there may be days where you feel better and days where you feel worse, yet the cancer remains. Also, if Tamar is feeling better, it may just be the placebo effect. This is the psychological subjective impression that a patient can have that she is feeling better simply because she's being given something that she believes is helping her. Now, the placebo effect can be very strong, but unfortunately, it doesn't mean that the treatment is having a real effect in her body. It's just her subjective impression of how she's feeling. Now, obviously, I don't know, but it may be related to the placebo effect. Now, once again, I'm not a doctor. All I know is a few scant facts of this case, and I don't know what treatment Tamar is on, and I certainly don't want to appear insensitive to the emotional suffering that the whole family must be going through. And I really, really hope that whatever treatment Tamar is getting, it really does work. But I have to say that whatever therapy that is, if it hasn't been tested and proven, then you just can't know if it will work. And given past experience with other alternative or natural therapies, it is highly likely that, in fact, it doesn't work. And it would seem to me that even if the chemotherapy only had a 30% chance of curing her cancer, that chance is most likely much, much higher than the probability of success from the so-called natural therapy. Now, finally, Trevor Stitt does raise a really important issue, and that is the issue of what Tamar's quality of life would be after the chemotherapy, even if her cancer is cured. Trevor said in his message that in Tamar's case, the chemotherapy would most likely leave her permanently deaf, wheelchair-bound, and incoherent, and unable to ever eat normally again. Now, I agree that her quality of life after treatment is a vital factor to be taken into account. And, of course, I have absolutely no idea of how likely those side effects that Mr. Stitt mentioned, how likely they actually are to occur. And because I have no idea, I actually contacted three oncologists and an eminent hepatologist working at various hospitals in Australia, and I asked them what the side effects from chemotherapy for hepatoblastoma might be. By the way, a hepatologist is a doctor who specializes in diseases of the liver, gallbladder, and pancreas. Now, the unanimous response that I received from those specialists was that, in their opinion, the chemotherapy would not produce complications as serious as those that Mr. Stitt mentioned, and that any side effects from the chemo would most likely be temporary and manageable. So, it seems to me that while going through chemotherapy must be a horrible experience and traumatic for the family as well to see their child suffering, it doesn't seem likely, at least in the opinion of the experts that I contacted, that Tamar would be permanently disabled. I wonder if maybe those side effects were mentioned to the family as possible side effects from the treatment, but not actually likely side effects. I mean, obviously, I don't know. I have no idea, but I'm just speculating here, that's all. The specialists that I contacted were also unanimous in saying that whatever alternative treatment Tamar is receiving, it is highly unlikely to be effective against her cancer. So, I mean, this is a very difficult and a very sad case. And if you're listening, Mr. Stitt, I hope you don't think that I'm attacking you in any way or that I'm insensitive to your situation. I'm simply offering my opinion out of a genuine concern that your family may have been misled by certain claims about the natural therapy that Tamar is receiving, and that you may be making a decision now that you will later regret. That's all. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say on this issue for today. It's obviously an extremely serious issue, and I feel I'm getting way out of my depth here. So to lighten things up a bit here on Reality Check, let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll take you to a place that I'm sure you'd be much too terrified to ever visit on your own, the Bermuda Triangle. So stay tuned for that here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was by Barry Manilow from the year 1980, and the song Bermuda Triangle, which is actually an amazing coincidence because that's today's topic up for skeptical analysis. The Bermuda Triangle. Now, dear listener, I have to confess that while researching in preparation for today's show, I discovered that it is a sheer miracle that I am here today broadcasting to you on Reality Check. You see, I discovered that the Bermuda Triangle is a triangular area of the Atlantic Ocean between Bermuda in the northeast corner, Puerto Rico in the southeast corner, and Miami in the western corner. And I realized, to my horror, that back in 2003, when I had taken a flight from San Juan, Puerto Rico, to Chicago in the US, my plane must have flown directly over the Bermuda Triangle. Now, once I'd recovered from the shock of what must clearly have been a brush with certain death, I wondered how I could ever have done something so reckless and foolhardy, flying straight across the heart of the Bermuda Triangle. I must have been crazy. Or so many authors would have you believe. I was inspired to talk about the Bermuda Triangle today by a BBC radio documentary currently being broadcast in the UK and available online, in which journalist Tom Mangold conducts an investigation into whether the stories surrounding the Bermuda Triangle actually have any truth behind them. So what are those stories about the Bermuda Triangle? Well, supposedly, over the last 150 years or so, hundreds of planes and boats that have ventured into the area have completely disappeared without a trace. That amounts to literally thousands of people just gone, swallowed up, never to be seen again. No one knows what happened, but some people have speculated that they were sucked up by a bizarre atmospheric phenomenon, a kind of horrifying hole in the sky. Others have spoken of magnetic vortices capable of warping gravity and even the space-time continuum itself. Scientists have apparently detected strange, unexplained magnetic forces in the area. It seems that the normal laws of physics just don't apply there. So what's going on? Is it a supernatural, secret subterranean power source? Or could it be that the forces of nature are being manipulated by extraterrestrials? Maybe it's leftover technology from the lost, sunken continent of Atlantis. Well, all these theories have been posited by numerous authors over the last 50 years or so. But I mean, what else could it be? I mean, how do you explain the loss of the British South American Airways plane, the Star Tiger, that just disappeared on a flight from the Azores in Portugal to Bermuda on the 30th of January 1948? None of the 31 people on board or any wreckage of the plane were ever found. And almost exactly a year later, on the 17th of January 1949, another plane, the Star Ariel, was flying from Bermuda to Jamaica and just disappeared without any trace ever being found. Or what about Flight 19? Actually, a group of five US Navy bombers flying over the Bermuda Triangle in 1945. The harrowing last words of the flight leader were, "We are entering white water. Nothing seems right. We don't know where we are. The water is green. No white." And that was it. And what about the USS Cyclops, a massive coal carrier that in March 1918, while crossing the Bermuda Triangle with 306 people on board, simply vanished off the face of the earth without any trace whatsoever? Or the SS Marine Sulphur Queen, carrying 39 crew members, that simply disappeared off the coast of Florida in 1963. The list goes on and on. So what about all those countless ships and aircraft that just disappeared? Well, no. I mean, really, that does it. The Bermuda Triangle, it's just too dangerous to visit. No, I've decided I'm never going to go there in my life. Oh, but wait, I already have been there. And I survived. And actually, now that I think about it, millions of other people have been there too. And they all survived. And thousands of people even live on islands within the Bermuda Triangle. And they're still alive, and hundreds, if not thousands, of boats and cargo ships and cruise liners and planes of all sizes must pass through that region every day, all without incident. So maybe all this hype and paranoia about the Bermuda Triangle is not entirely justified. Maybe there's actually no reason to fear the Bermuda Triangle at all. Well, dear listener, you guessed it. There is, in fact, no reason to fear the Bermuda Triangle. Investigation after investigation, including the latest one by the BBC, have found that there is nothing in any way unusual or mysterious about that particularly high traffic zone of the Atlantic. And the story of the Bermuda Triangle serves as a perfect illustration of how straightforward or slightly unusual stories get embellished and exaggerated and blown up out of all proportion, and then new, completely made-up stories get added to them, all in a self-perpetuating cycle of increasing frenzy and hype that fuels the sales of sensationalist books and magazines and the ratings of so-called TV specials. That's how these myths start, and that's what keeps them bubbling along. Because no matter how many serious investigative journalists or institutions prepare a detailed and comprehensive report giving perfectly rational explanations as to how a particular boat or aeroplane disappeared, there are always going to be people on the other side who have an interest in maintaining the mystery, in manipulating facts, and making up stories. We've seen it time and time again. We saw it with the supposed UFO incident at Roswell. We've even seen a version of it just in the last few weeks here on Reality Check with our expose of the completely unscientific blood type diet. Whatever I or any other skeptics say is not going to stop Dr. Dodamo from coming out with another best-selling diet book based on completely unsound pseudoscientific theories. But let's get back to the Bermuda Triangle. How did it all begin, and what did the investigators find? Well, it all began back in 1950 with an article by journalist E.V.W. Jones in the Associated Press discussing three unrelated cases of disappearances of a ship and several planes over the previous 5 years, and linking the cases together for no obvious reason, all as mysterious disappearances. This basically sparked the interest of other journalists who came up with similar stories over the next few years, often getting the facts wrong. And then those wrong facts were repeated when the stories were taken up by other journalists. Finally, an article published by journalist Vincent Gaddis in the US pulp magazine Argosy in 1964 used the title "The Deadly Bermuda Triangle." This was the first time anyone had used the term Bermuda Triangle. It seemed to capture the public imagination, and the concept took off, particularly in the 60s and especially in the 70s, with countless articles and numerous books compiling lists of all the boats and planes that had ever disappeared in the region, citing them all as proof of a pattern of strange, unexplained phenomena occurring probably with supernatural elements. So then, what is the explanation for all these bizarre disappearances? So many boats and planes can't just disappear off the face of the earth, can they? Well, actually, it appears that they can. And especially back in the 40s and 50s, or even earlier, when most of the classic Bermuda Triangle incidents occurred, and when the techniques, particularly of air crash investigation, were not nearly as sophisticated as they are now. I'm afraid to say it, but the explanation in almost all the cases that have been investigated by serious scientific investigators is simply that the ship sank or the plane crashed into the sea. That's it. But why was there no wreckage? Well, because it sank to the bottom of the sea, or was carried away by currents. The ocean is a very, very big place, remember. And why were there no bodies? Well, maybe they sank too, or were eaten by sharks. In the end, all of the so-called unexplainable disappearances end up actually having pretty prosaic explanations. And it also turns out that a lot of the details added to the individual stories are simply not true. The author says the weather was perfect. How could a ship just disappear in perfect weather? Well, actually, when you go and investigate it and check the meteorological records for that day, you find there were almost hurricane-force winds blowing. The ship was in perfect working order, some author says. How could it just disappear? Well, actually, if you go and check the logs, the ship wasn't in good order. It had engine troubles and left port with only one engine running. The flight was going perfectly smoothly, the author says. How could it just vanish? Well, actually, when you investigate, you discover that for the amount of fuel that plane could carry, it was really at the limit of its range. You add the fact that it was flying into headwinds, so burning up extra fuel, and was flying at low altitude because its heater had broken down, and suddenly a supposedly unexplainable disappearance becomes much more explainable. And the list goes on and on. Every supposedly mysterious incident that gets a serious critical investigation suddenly also gets a pretty straightforward explanation. And the other thing to note is that often wreckage and bodies were found. But years later, when some author was churning out his or her latest chilling account of the deadly Bermuda Triangle, these minor details were conveniently omitted, and the incident was recounted as yet another completely mysterious disappearance without a trace. Finally, the other factor that puts the lie to the myth of the terrible dangers of venturing into the Bermuda Triangle is the fact that the US Coast Guard and the US Navy constantly point out that the waters of the Bermuda Triangle don't have any higher rates of incidents than other busy waters around the United States. And perhaps most telling of all, Lloyd's of London, a major insurer of international shipping, in fact, the major insurer, I think, states that the Bermuda Triangle is no different from any other busy shipping zone in the world. There are no higher losses there than in other busy areas, such as those around the Horn of Africa or through Southeast Asia. So planes disappear, ships are lost, but it happens everywhere in the world and with no greater frequency in the Bermuda Triangle. So fortunately, it seems that all my fears were misplaced. The Bermuda Triangle is just as safe a place to travel as anywhere else in the world, and its sinister reputation is purely the result of sloppy journalism, unscrupulous authors, and TV producers who place ratings ahead of truth. Also, one final comment about the Bermuda Triangle. I generally find it objectionable when people just make up stories and then put them out there as supposedly true just to sell their book or video or whatever. It's objectionable even in cases where no one was actually hurt, such as the supposed UFO conspiracy surrounding Roswell in New Mexico. But in cases where there were actual major tragedies that involved loss of life, I somehow find it particularly reprehensible. For example, the 9/11 truthers, as they call themselves, and the Bermuda Triangle theories as well. As I mentioned before, accidents that have occurred in the Bermuda Triangle have claimed thousands of lives over the years, so there must be grieving families left behind. And to write a book to try to cash in on some ridiculous paranormal theories about the event just seems particularly low to me. Anyway, as I said, our discussion today on the Bermuda Triangle was inspired by a 10-part BBC radio series by investigative journalist Tom Mangold. And that series is going on now, going from the 14th to the 25th of September. And I can highly recommend having a listen. It's a great example of a detailed, skeptical investigation of a so-called paranormal mystery, and includes interviews with famous paranormal investigators Joe Nickell and Ben Radford. So if you want to check it out, the website is a bit complicated, so just Google BBC Bermuda Triangle to find the BBC webpage article about the radio show. Then at the bottom of that page, there's a link to the program website. But if you're interested, do hurry, because the episodes are only online to listen to for a few days each. Now, finally, before we get into our final song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com. That's realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. And don't forget, you can also visit our blog page too, if you like. That's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. We're also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was Duele el Amor by Ana Torroja from Spain and Alex Sintek from Mexico. Now, let's get into our movie review. But first today, a little bit of movie news to start, and it comes from the Venice International Film Festival, which wrapped up last week, and which, since 2007, has given out an award called The Queer Lion to the best movie with LGBT themes and queer culture. The Venice Film Festival started in 1932 and is actually the oldest film festival in the world. Each year they give out the Golden Lion to the best film of the festival, plus several Silver Lions for various categories, and now for the last 3 years, the Queer Lion. And this year's Queer Lion went to a film called A Single Man, starring Colin Firth and Julianne Moore. And Colin Firth actually also won the award for Best Actor for his role in that film. A Single Man is based on a 1964 novel by British author Christopher Isherwood and is directed by Tom Ford, an American fashion designer. And this is his directorial debut, apparently. So it sounds interesting, a movie to look out for over the next few months. And rest assured, dear listener, when it eventually does come out here in Melbourne, one of the first places you'll hear it reviewed will be here on Reality Check. All right, now let's come back to the present and get into this week's movie review. And our movie up for review today is The Young Victoria, which tells the story of the young Queen Victoria in the early years of her reign, covering the period from a year before her coronation in 1838 up until shortly after her marriage to Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha in 1840. Now, this film is extremely romantic, and I have to say that I loved it. The script, the performances, the production design are all fantastic. Now, normally I'm not a big fan of romances, but I found this one really effective and touching and really well done, mainly because of the sterling performances of the two protagonists, Emily Blunt as the young Victoria and Rupert Friend as the young Prince Albert. They bring a real charm to the screen, especially Emily Blunt, who just shines. She's fantastic. I'd never seen her before, but she's definitely a talent to watch out for, in my opinion. Now, the other thing I liked about this movie was the historical element. I have to confess that I knew virtually nothing about the early reign of Victoria, and I can't remember seeing another movie dealing with this period, so I found the story all very fresh and all very interesting. And I know it's an overused word when describing the production design in period dramas like this, but for me, the sets and the decor and the costumes are sumptuous, a real feast for the eyes. And what's more, this film has particular relevance to the LGBT community here in Melbourne. How could that be, I hear you ask? A movie about Queen Victoria relevant to LGBT people in Melbourne today? Well, yes. In at least three ways that I could think of, maybe more. First, we live in a state named after her, Victoria. Well, okay, that one is pretty obvious. Now, second, well, the Prime Minister of the time and the other potential suitor competing against Albert for Victoria's affection was none other than Lord Melbourne, after whom our fair city was named. So that's interesting, isn't it? But what about the LGBT connection, I hear you ask? Well, hang on, I'm getting there. The story of Victoria's succession to the throne all happens against the backdrop of the political rivalry and machinations between Lord Melbourne, the leader of the Whigs, and the leader of the Conservatives, Sir Robert Peel. And did you know, dear listener, that one of Melbourne's oldest and most iconic gay bars is The Peel, whose full name is actually the Sir Robert Peel Hotel, named after the two-time Conservative British Prime Minister of the mid-19th century. So there you go, all the pieces come together in the most unexpected of ways. Anyway, back to the movie itself. I reckon it's great, very romantic, historically interesting and highly entertaining. Worth checking out, in my opinion. And that brings us to the end of the 8th episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit the website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 9. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.